Hello and welcome to the very first Radio Daleks of 2008. I'm John Peters Coleman, presenter of this week's show, and a happy new year to you all. We're back in the studio at the British Empire and Commonwealth Museum at Temple Meads in Bristol. The museum is due to close in the autumn, so why not visit the museum's fascinating displays and see the current exhibition on slavery, Breaking the Chains, before it moves up to London. The museum's next to Brunel's famous railway station, so it's easy to find. And for more details, log on to their website at www.empiremuseum.co.uk. In today's programme, we have guests Martin Summers talking about his experience as an aid worker in Bosnia, and Malcolm Grieve, who will give us a witty insight into the music of the 70s. We have a unique recording from the audio archives here at the museum. We have a report from Tony Gosling, some reminiscences of early Doctor Who, a poem from Kristen Powers, and Dalek's Jeff Sparks with his weekly feature of What's On. Now we go over to Tony Gosling for the news.
The leader of the Pakistan People's Party in the UK says the US and Pakistani spy agencies, the CIA and the ISI, are the number one suspects behind the assassination of his party leader, Benazir Bhutto. Her assassination is calculated. Her killing is a fascist act. US Central Intelligence Agency and Pakistan Inter-Service Intelligence should shoulder responsibility for her assassination. Amanullah Khan, a Britain-based leader of the PPP, said last week, according to the Times of India. He added, Bhutto was longing to go back to Pakistan in an effort to restore democracy there, but was deceived and stabbed in the back by the CIA and ISI. Meanwhile, Khalid Mahmood, a Labour MP, has said Bhutto knew the threat to her life, but the West cajoled and forced her to return to Pakistan. The son of the slain Pakistani opposition leader told reporters last Tuesday that Washington's policy of appeasing dictators is one of the main factors behind the expansion of extremism in the world. Before her assassination on 2nd of November 2007 on the Al Jazeera show, Frost Over the World, Benazir Bhutto stated the following. One of them is a very key figure in security. He's a former military officer. He also had dealings with Omar Sheikh, the man who murdered Osama bin Laden. Internal security has totally collapsed in Pakistan, and internal security cannot collapse without a blind eye being turned. The US Navy has withdrawn last week's allegation that Iranian patrol boats threatened to blow up a three-ship US convoy in the Straits of Hormuz. It could have been a threat aimed at some other nation or a myriad of other things, the Washington Post quoted US Navy spokesman Rear Admiral Frank Thorpe as saying on Friday. This is while senior US Navy sources have told the BBC that an alleged threat to blow up the US warships may not have come from Iranian boats. The Pentagon alleged five Iranian boats belonging to the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps had harassed three US Navy warships by threatening to blow them up last Sunday. No one in the military has said the transmission emanated from those boats, said Pentagon spokesman Jeff Morrell. However, President Bush characterized the incident as provocative and dangerous, warning Iran of serious consequences if it happens again. Iranian officials have dismissed the allegation, saying the incident was a routine maritime identification check, which is common between vessels in the Persian Gulf. 1,000 theatre lovers turned out this week to a meeting in the auditorium of the Old Vic Theatre in Bristol. Dick Penny, who runs the Watershed Media Centre and recently took over as chairman of the theatre's trustees, unveiled plans for its future. Mr. Penny said he would like work on the refurbishment of the 241-year-old theatre to start sooner rather than later, and that the management had to focus on the elements of refurbishment that were really essential. All electrics, plumbing and heating need replacing. There were necessary structural repairs as well as disabled access to consider. This had been costed at £9 million, and the money pledged by the public has reached a total of £6 million. Mr. Penny said scaled-down work could start this year. Councillor Richard Eddy told the packed auditorium that there was cross-party support on the council for Dick Penny. And Mr. Penny said, "We have to look at reinventing the theatre and creating some artistic creativity, which will also create some revenue. This has to be a producing organisation, but in the short term, let's try and get the place open." Two Bristol area primary schools had to be evacuated yesterday after being cut off by rising floodwater. Chewstoke Church Primary School in Chewstoke was cut off when its only access route was swamped by 3 feet of water. Head teacher Sarah Fuller said two parents had to abandon their flooded cars and swim to the school. She said the children were all fine and only realised there was a flood when they went outside, but the parents were very distressed. Then they all had to clamber over the walls and gardens to get to their cars and back home. King's Hill School in Nailsea also had to be evacuated after floodwater started to rise around the building. Staff had to ring parents of its 157 students on Friday lunchtime to ask them to collect students early. Head teacher Heather Dowding said, "We sent the children home early as a precaution. The floodwater around the school was rising rapidly and we were concerned it was going to come into the building." The RSPCA has called on retailers to stop selling cheap meat, in particular chickens that have been reared in poor conditions. The RSPCA says shoppers should be prepared to pay more for chickens to ensure they live a more humane life. The charity wants supermarkets to sell only chickens that qualify as higher welfare chicken, that is, free-range organic, or produced to its own Freedom Food Standards by 2010. Of the 853 million chickens reared for their meat in the UK every year, the majority are kept in cramped and dimly lit spaces. Shoppers are already discriminating between battery and free-range eggs. 38% of all eggs come from non-caged birds. In contrast, only 5% of chickens reared for meat are raised in higher welfare conditions. The charity's campaign, which was launched last week, coincides with the short season of Channel 4 programmes featuring Jamie Oliver and Hugh Fearnley Whittingshaw, which focuses on chicken farming and the hideous realities of industrial chicken production. It's hoped the programmes will persuade the supermarket chains to change their ways and the public to stop buying cheap chickens. The RSPCA has created an online petition to put pressure on retailers at supportchickensnow.co.uk.
If you ever drive through Wiltshire, or anywhere near the town of Warminster, you'll be driving near a ghost village. Even though there are about 20 to 30 houses, a manor house, a pub, and a church there, the place is completely deserted. This town is called Imber, and the reason it's deserted is because it's now part of the Army's training area of Salisbury Plain. Every year, Ruth Underwood, daughter of Austin Underwood, who lived in Imber, organises a small peace vigil on New Year's Eve. Ken Mitchell was born in Imber and evicted in the Second World War. Because the army promised to let the villagers return after the war, and then completely failed to, he is drawn to Imber every year, the village where he grew up. Dialect's Tony Gosling spoke to him on New Year's Eve, on one of the rare days when the village is open to the public.
My name is Ken Mitchell. I was born here in the village in 1926, a grandson of Albert Nash the blacksmith, and Martha Nash was my grandmother. The reason I'm back here today is because, number one, it is always an experience to come back here to the village, and my childhood, obviously, thoughts go back to that and the times I spent in my dearly part of my life here.
So the church has recently been restored, I think.
This is it. This is the whole point now. This really is something that I regard as being particularly good. The church now has been restored. It is now weatherproof, and it can now be. Its future is assured. There is no doubt about it.
But what's the point, though, in having a church when it's so difficult for anyone to actually get in here?
That's a good point. It's a very good point. But maybe the fact that a considerable amount of money has been spent on the church, I think that there is a future now for the church. I feel that the surrounding area here, perhaps not in my time, but in the future, as the army changes and the picture now is, it's beginning to show that the army, as we have today, doesn't need all this mass of this area that they have in, which is Salisbury Plain. I doubt if I will see the day when it's handed over, but I think that this part of southern England is a valuable area. It is most important that it is still kept as an open space. And why not hand this part of the plain over to the population of this country? Because I'm sure it is something that it is valuable.
Well, it's certainly a unique place, Imber. I mean, for somebody who's lived maybe in a Wiltshire area, they may well never have had the chance to actually drive into Imber because most of the year it's cut off. Now, the way the village is now, we've got blockhouses, most of them two-storey blockhouses, that is to say just literally bare walls with no real windows, just kind of window openings in the walls. Looking around us, you can see maybe 20 of these blockhouses the army used for training. How does it compare with the original village that you grew up in?
Ah, good point. It doesn't compare at all with the original village.
But we've still got the manor house, we've still got the Bell Inn. It's a sort of pretend pub. I mean, it's got a pub sign saying the Bell outside it, for authenticity, I imagine, when the army are doing their training.
Oh, well, that's right. But the point is, you see, these block houses, which are intermingled with some of the houses that were built here in 1937-38, these are easily distinguished by the fact that they are brick built. You see, there's a block here of brick built buildings. They were inhabited at the time of the eviction. These other houses here, they have been added, and so it's completely distorted the image of the village as it was.
Can you remember the eviction still? What was it like?
That's a difficult question to say what it was like. I was 17 years old at the time, and it was mixed feelings as far as I was concerned. The fact that this is looking at it from a personal point of view, I would be leaving the village anyhow myself within a year or so, because I would be conscripted into the services. To me, it was no big deal. But to the elders of my family, my parents, my grandparents in particular, particularly my grandfather, and it was a terrific blow to them to be told in early November that they would be leaving their homes, and they, with virtually nowhere to go. And Grandad in particular, immediately he was told this, to him it was the end. It was the end of his life. And so obviously that grandfather taking it so badly, my mother, not his daughter, she was terribly upset by this thing, and it was a very, very sad occasion. But perhaps at that time the war was at a critical, it was a critical time at the war, but the oncoming invasion of Europe, which most people were aware of, and there was a feeling that everyone wanted to help the war effort. And I think this is what the Imber people thought in that time, that we'll do this, we will move out. They didn't really know what they were moving out for, except for the fact they were told that it was the Americans wanted it for street fighting. There was a feeling that everyone wanted to help the war effort, and I think this is what the Imber people thought in that time, that we'll do this, we will move out. They didn't really know what they were moving out for, except for the fact they were told that it was the Americans wanted it for street fighting.
Ken Mitchell there, born in the ghost village of Imber near Warminster on the Salisbury Plain, talking to Dialects' Tony Gosling. Kirsty McColl. Our first guest in the studio today is Martin Summers, and we're going to talk today about his experiences as an aid worker in Bosnia for the Catholic Fund for Overseas Development. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Now, you were an aid worker in Bosnia, which is a part of the former Yugoslavia. Why you've got a particular interest in that area of the world at the moment. What's going on?
Well, the main international interest in the area at the moment is over the proposed independence of Kosovo, which is in the far south of former Yugoslavia, currently still officially part of Serbia. Tony Blair and Mr. Clinton declared war on Serbia to force Serbian troops out of Kosovo some years ago. The place has been in a bit of a limbo since then, but it's gradually been coming to a head, and it's possible that the current government of Kosovo will declare a unilateral declaration of independence sometime very soon. Serbia is absolutely opposed to this declaration of independence, as is Russia. And therefore, there's a potential, I will put it no stronger than that, for war to reignite in the Balkans. Mm-hmm. So that's really the reason why I'm here today, is to just make people aware that this could be coming over the horizon.
All right, so this is a problem that isn't recent. This has been going on for 15 years, 20 years, however long. I mean, apart from sort of, I suppose, territorial interests on Serbia's part, what sort of real politic reasons are there for Serbia to want to keep Kosovo?
Well, Kosovo is very important to Serbs culturally because in many respects a lot of the cultural icons for the Serbs are based in Kosovo. They had things like monasteries and churches and so on. And they've got a very strong emotional attachment to Kosovo. There was a very, very big battle there in the Middle Ages where Serbia was defeated by the Turks, the Battle of Kosovopolje, and Serbs had a long and strong emotional attachment to the land of Kosovo. But of course, in actual numbers terms, the majority population there is Albanian-speaking and Muslim, and the tension and conflict between Serbs and Albanians has been going on for a very long time and was really triggered the Yugoslav wars of the 1990s when Serbia withdrew Kosovo's nominal independence, nominal autonomy, not independence. This was the, if people remember, Slobodan Milosevic, who's now dead, he made a big career out of persecuting the Kosovans, and the Kosovans have responded in kind by seeking to escape completely from Serbian control. All of these countries, you've got to remember, Yugoslavia was put together at the end of the Second World War, at the end of the First World War, as a kind of multinational state.
Yeah.
But it's got very, very varied population within that multinational state. Not so much varied in language. I mean, Kosovans speak Albanian, and most of the rest of Yugoslavia, they speak versions of Serbo-Croat. But more in terms of economic development. So Slovenia in the north of Yugoslavia is now part of the EU and has managed, it was the first state to get independence from Yugoslavia with encouragement from Germany in particular. And they have done rather well out of the whole situation. They had a brief war against the Yugoslav army in 91. It took about 70 days, the Yugoslav army withdrew, Slovenia declared independence, it was recognised by the Germans, amongst others, and by the EU, and they, of course, have now become part of the EU and relatively prosperous. At the other end of the spectrum, you've got Kosovo, which is one of the countries, which was one of the areas which most had most problems with Serbia, but they are still not resolving their situation. But Kosovo is a poor country, it's got large families, big unemployment, no modern industry to speak of, and Yugoslavia as a whole, as a communist country, was one of the communist countries that really did open up to the West early on, in the sense that they took loans from the IMF and the World Bank and private banks. But in a way, Yugoslavia was kept together by this borrowed money. But of course, when the time came for the money to be paid back, there was a huge problem. Wealthier republics felt that they were carrying the poorer republics and they wanted to try and get away from that.
Right.
The poorer republics felt that they were supplying raw materials at a cheap rate to the northern, more developed republics, and that they were being ripped off. So in a sense, Yugoslavia is one country in which it's got a whole spectrum of economic and political configurations, like as if it was a whole continent or a whole or the whole world.
Right. I mean, in terms of the economic and political differences, the independence that Kosovo feels it should have, what percentage of that is kind of based on cultural differences? If Serbia feels that they have a lot of cultural links, and what part of that is really just sort of real politic or economic?
Well, I mean, to be honest with you, if you think about it, all of these little countries are neighbours to each other, and in a sense, they're natural economic partners. So the breakup of Yugoslavia was, in a sense, an unnatural thing to happen. I think a lot of it now is just to do with the sheer hatred that there is between the Serbian community and the Albanian community. There have been atrocities on both sides, and I think that it's just reached the point where they just feel they can't live together. My own view would be that the Kosovans do not, in fact, have to have full independence in order to get on with doing what they want to do.
What do you see as the alternative options then?
Well, I mean, the alternative option is what you've actually got, which is that Kosovo is in practice independent of Serbia, but it's not been recognised as an independent state, and Kosovans, in a sense, by pushing for recognition as an independent state, are kind of provoking the Serbs when they don't need to. I mean, basically, they've got pretty much what they want anyway. Serbia doesn't control what goes on inside Kosovo, so in a sense, the Kosovans are pushing for, you know, a piece of paper that says they're independent, which they don't really need to have. Although, of course, they don't see it like that. They see it as a matter of principle.
I mean, Belgium is, although we talk about it as one country, is technically a federation of two different parts.
Quite so.
Do you think that is where Serbia and Kosovo should somehow be moving towards?
Well, I mean, that suggestions have been made along those lines. The problem is that there's so much bad blood between the two sides now. And we're not just talking about politicians here. It's like it's kind of deeply ingrained in both communities that they're enemies of each other, a bit like Northern Ireland, a bit like Belgium. And I think all of these kind of conflicts, and there's plenty of them around the world, can be pushed to the limit, in which case, you know, violence usually results, or people can accept less than 100% independence. I mean, the Northern Ireland peace process, for example, John Hume, the SDLP leader, Catholic leader in Ireland, said that the peace process was a hologram so that everybody could see what they wanted to see in it.
Right.
So for the Unionists, it guaranteed that they would not be forced into United Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
For the Republicans, it guaranteed that the United Ireland would remain on the agenda so that both sides could see what they wanted in it and therefore were able to find a compromise. I think a compromise of similar kind in Kosovo and Serbia has been very difficult to find because of the ill feeling that's been generated by previous violence.
Are there any economic advantages to them staying together particularly?
Well, I mean, let's face it, as I said earlier, I mean, these countries are all neighbours. It's
yeah.
Like saying, is there an economic advantage for England and Wales to stay united to each other? Well, they are next door to each other, and motorways cross the bridge, the two bridges, and link the two countries. So, in a sense, you know, you can't get away from the fact that you have to trade with your neighbours, whoever you are.
Is there any... Is membership to the EU a draw at all to trying to work things out?
I think that has been dangled in front of Serbia as a possible positive outcome if they were to show flexibility.
Mm.
I think it's difficult to just draw countries into the EU because, you know, if you're going to accept things like the euro and, you know, getting your budget deficit within the Maastricht criteria and so on, it's not actually just a straightforward membership of a club.
No.
You know, you've got to actually be economically capable of joining the EU. Otherwise, it can destroy you. I mean, you join with a weak economy and you could end up losing all your industry, for example, to stronger countries. So it's not necessarily a panacea.
I mean, as Turkey has shown, that has been dragging out for years, and their culture is so difficult to resolve with what the EU demands of them. I suppose, you know, your point is a good one in that it's, you know, that's going to be very difficult to resolve in the immediate future. So do you see this problem just sort of dragging out for years?
I think it does. I mean, and I think the problem with the whole, what they call Euro-Atlantic integration, becoming part of the EU, joining NATO, which is what a lot of East European countries have done, is that wherever you draw the line, there's somebody on the other side of it who feels left out. And of course, that we've seen in recent years the Russians getting fed up with being feeling as if they've been pushed out of their traditional sphere of influence in Eastern Europe and in the Caucasus, and are now a reaction developing to that of we don't want the EU, we don't want NATO. I mean, you'll be aware that both Poland and Czechoslovakia have agreed to put this missile defence bases in their countries, and that's very much annoying the Russians, because they see it as directed
American,
at them.
Yes, so
the American base of this. The Russians see this very much as directed at them. And the Russian position on all of this would be, look, we've bent over backwards to be flexible with the West over the last 20, 25 years. We've given away a lot of previous positions that we were strongly defending. But all we've ever got from that is kind of abuse and further attempts to destabilise our setup. And you can see that there is some justification in this kind of view. The danger is, over Kosovo, that the US will line up on one side, the Russians will line up on the other, and it restarts a whole Cold War situation in Europe, which of course is not really in anybody's long-term interests.
In terms of this tussle between America and Russia, do you think Kosovo and Serbia and that situation. He's just going to get pulled around like a pawn in the middle. And
I think that's what's made the situation so potentially dangerous, because the US have virtually told the Kosovans that whatever that however strong their demands are, they will be supported. And because the Serbs have been told by the Russians that as long as they stick to their guns, the Russians will support them, there's not been much encouragement to compromise on either side. And I think, in general, we're moving to a situation where the US is in conflict with the Russian state, and also potentially with China. So we're moving back to a kind of confrontational world, rather than a world in which we've all got shared values and we're trying to achieve, you know, shared objectives.
Right. I mean, the UN presumably must be in that whole former Yugoslav area. What role do they play in this?
Well, the UN, as we've just been saying, the UN Security Council is the key player, and the UN Security Council is split. The war to liberate Kosovo, if we can call it that, some years ago, was done without UN backing because the Russians did not support the attack on Serbia. Some suggest that in actual fact the Serbs were manipulated into that war by being given kind of ultimatums which they couldn't possibly accept as an excuse for the breakup of Yugoslavia and the destruction of Greater Serbia. My own views, having been an aid worker in Bosnia, are that it's the closer you get to these conflicts, the more complicated they are. I think that the Serbs were largely responsible for the violence in the former Yugoslavia. Something certainly had to be done about their rather aggressive attitude towards their neighbours. Nevertheless, it was dramatically mishandled by the West. Dramatically mishandled, for example, by Slovenia was granted independence and recognition almost immediately.
Yeah.
But that was like taking one piece out of a Jenga pyramid and expecting the rest of the pyramid to hold up.
Mm.
No arrangements have been made for anybody else, not for Croatia, not for Bosnia, not for Kosovo, and this is why it's still dragging on. And I don't think that the West should have recognised breakaway republics without a fully comprehensive plan for the whole of the situation.
Yeah.
Because what you're effectively doing is you're saying that Catholics who are like us and have a similar standard of living to us should be welcomed into the fold.
Yeah.
Poor Muslims can go and get lost.
Right.
And of course that is not the best way to convince people that you've got everybody's best interests at heart. And I think that a lot of that was pushed by Germany. Germany pushed very hard for Croatia and Slovenia to be recognised as independent states. The British Foreign Office, to their credit, resisted this pressure. I mean, nobody's saying that they shouldn't be allowed to be independent in practice.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a question of whether you recognise this as some kind of big, you know, flag-waving exercise.
Yeah.
But the Germans were pushing for recognition of Croatia. The British Foreign Office said, well, we can't just recognise Croatia. What do we do about Kosovo, for example, if we recognise Croatia?
Mm.
But John Major was the Prime Minister at the time, and he went to the Maastricht to discuss the Maastricht Treaty with the Germans, and in the sidelines of that discussion, the Germans said, we will allow Britain to opt out of the social chapter of the Maastricht Treaty.
Yeah.
Which I don't know if people remember at the time that there was a big hoo-ha inside the Conservative Party here about the social chapter and we didn't want it in Britain.
Mm.
So Major got a deal from Helmut Kohl whereby he would be able to opt out of the social chapter, which incidentally we opted back into as soon as Blair was elected.
Right.
But on that basis, Germany pushed for the recognition of Croatia, which was then accepted. But of course that then led to Bosnia being left part of rump Yugoslavia. So as each state breaks away from Yugoslavia, the ones that are left facing a bigger Serbia with a smaller support of their own to counterbalance that. So they all have to push for independence. Most of the Bosnian Muslims I spoke to did not want to be independent. They wanted to be part of federal Yugoslavia. But once Slovenia and Croatia have declared independence,
well, they're doing it.
They had no choice. Mm. They felt they had no choice.
Mm.
But I think the whole thing was mishandled by the West. And then, of course, when everybody starts fighting and killing each other, the West just stands aside and wrings its hands and goes, oh, my God, these crazy Balkan people.
Yeah. I mean, the people in Kosovo, the powers that be, must be looking at, you know, their hand extremely carefully and seeing and weighing up their choices as we speak. I mean, how confident do you think they're going to be, given all of the pressures and the outside influences? I mean, do you really think they are going to?
Well, I imagine what's actually going on behind the scenes is that the Kosovans are being spoken to by EU diplomats saying, well, look, do you really have to go for this declaration of independence? And that's why it hasn't happened yet.
Right.
My argument would be very similar to that, to say to the Kosovans, look, you've pretty much got everything you want. Do you actually need a piece of paper to say it as well?
Okay.
If it's going to antagonise the Serbs, when there's no, there's no reason to antagonise them. But of course, from a Kosovan point of view, especially after all the suffering they've been through at the hands of the Serbs, there's an element of them just saying, no, we want the piece of paper, we want to be independent.
Yeah. In the immediate next few days, what do you think is the best thing that you could hear in the news in an ideal situation?
I would like to hear that the discussions are continuing.
Right.
Yeah. That's often the best solution for a problem, is just to carry on talking about it.
Keep talking.
And keep talking about it.
Okay. Thank you very much for your time today, Martin Summers. All the best. Thank you very much for coming in today. We're off to India today with two short extracts from the Empire and Commonwealth Museum's archives from the end of British rule in India. Our first is from a lady who was born in 1930s India, Hazel Hooper.
When I travelled, my ayah used to take my lipstick and I'd say, oh, I didn't know you liked to wear bits on your face. No, I'm done. I'm putting big red cross on forehead. Being Christian may not kill me. I'm not Hindu, not Muslim, Christian, you see. But I was travelling with the baby, one baby then, with my ayah. I don't remember whether she put a cross on herself or not, but I do remember the train was stopped between the stations with a horde of Muslims. And I thought, this is it. I've got a little Hindu ayah here. So I stuck her under the place I was sitting and put baby's napkins that we had, nappies, draped them as if I was drying them all along. So they didn't see her, and they never saw her. They opened the door, looked in, saw me with a little white baby with blonde hair sticking up. I never saw her under there. And after that, she used to kiss my feet and say, Mem Sahib saved my life.
When I went out in the late 1950s, there were different groups of people. There were government advisors sent out from England to set up projects, to help the Indian government, to work alongside various projects. There were a lot of people in banks. Banks and insurance were still very much in British hands, although, in fact, they were Indian, and they were 51% Indian and 49% British. There were a lot of people still in education. In the school when I went out, the headmaster was British, and there were three or four expats like me. There were still a lot of people who worked in religious circles as well. The Bishop of Bombay, to my astonishment, was an Englishman. Remained so for 10 years. There were a lot more people who were out there looking for trade. The big Shell, Unilevers, all these big firms. Now, that made the population of British people very transient. People came out for 3 years and they moved. The British did not stay. After 1947, there were more British in India, but they stayed a very, very short time. They didn't have that continuity. And very, very slowly, that eroded a lot of the contacts that were made in India.
Carla Contactor there, an English lady who remained in India well into the 50s, along with a lot of other English people, after Indian independence. Okay, well, according to the history books, the Colossus of Rhodes, one of the great wonders of the world, collapsed and fell into the sea. But I know different. It donned a black shirt, grew a goatee beard and moved to Bristol. And here he is now, it's Jeff Sparks for this week's What's On Guide.
Thank you, John. Good afternoon. This is a What's On Guide from Dialect Radio. Starting with Thursday, 17th of January, at the Fleece and Firkin in Bristol, Stone Gods will be performing. Now, this group features former members of the Darkness, but don't expect a musical style like that group. Tickets are £11 in advance, and doors open at 8pm. Moving on to Friday, 18th of January, and it's time to get your dancing shoes on, because at the Palm Bar in Gloucester Road in Bristol, the Madness tribute group One Step Below will be performing. Entry is £4 on the door, and doors open at 8 p.m. On to a song of the week, and this week the honours go to Topo Negative. This is a track titled My Girlfriend's Girlfriend, and it's from the album October Rust. Negative with the track My Girlfriend's Girlfriend. For more information on this group, you can check out www.topo-negative.net. Moving on to Saturday, 19th of January, the female-fronted rock covers group Angel Up Front will be performing at the Reckless Engineer in Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. Also on Saturday, and this time at the Palm Bar in Gloucester Road in Bristol, the Boogie Woogie and Jump Jive pianist Rockin' Robert will be performing with his band. Doors open at 8 p.m. and entry is £4 on the door. Finally, on a Sunday, 20th of January, at the Old Tavern in Stapleton in Bristol, the local punk and new wave covers group The Mutoids will be performing. Entry is free and the gig should start around 9 p.m. That is all from me today. Thank you for listening and have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
Thank you very much, Jeff. Our intrepid reporter, Anthea Page, recorded some reminiscences from Andre Wellstead Hornby and Graham Lowe, who were set designers at the BBC and worked on early episodes of Doctor Who.
You worked on the first Doctor Who.
I've worked on the first series of Doctor Who, and I worked on Doctor Who and the Saracens, which I think was the second story in the series.
And can you tell us what you did on Doctor Who?
I was assistant for the scenery, for the designer, and I did everything from spraying sawdust to painting scenery.
What was the sawdust for?
Because you're not allowed sand near cameras. So we used it as sand in the desert, because we had a fort in the desert and we had Arabs on horses and things down at Ligrove Studios.
Oh, so you actually did it in the studio?
Yes, it was all done inside.
And who was the Doctor Who then?
William Hartnell.
Oh, was he good to work with or...?
You had to keep a lot of handkerchiefs because he used to get very tearful and his feet hurt. So he used to get a bit emotional about it.
Oh, why did his feet hurt?
I don't know, but he was always having to swap his shoes and sit down and have people ministering to him.
Tell me what happened about Tom Baker.
Oh, well, he was filming the next series and
Doctor Who,
and he was being driven by the buyer through a small town, and he looked at his watch and he suddenly realised it was time for Doctor Who, so he jumped out of the car, banged on somebody's door, and stood there with his muffler and his hat while the two children who opened the door's mouths flew open, and he said, "Can I come in and watch Doctor Who with you?" And then he bundled and sat on the sofa with these two kids to watch the whole of Doctor Who, and they couldn't believe their luck.
And it used to be on a trailer sitting outside, you know, just sort of gathering dust and dirt, and if it was, "Oh, we need the TARDIS," you think, "Oh God, you have to have the bloody TARDIS," and you get it in, it was, you know, bits were missing, and you'd have to try and kind of cod something.
It was all like that, wasn't it?
Nothing. No, so it was a terrible.
Did it have a movable side, though, so it could disappear?
No, because you never went in it, you only just had it in the studio, and then the actual interior of the TARDIS was the build, but the box, the actual telephone box, well, it was taken out on filming quite a bit, wasn't it? It had to appear somewhere.
Was it only ever one TARDIS, or were there several?
No, there's only ever one TARDIS.
Oh.
I think. I don't know whether it was always that drum thing that went up and down, wasn't there? And I don't know who, I suppose, Rake designed that originally. Did he design the very first one? Because I know he designed the Daleks, but
yes,
whether he...
I don't remember anybody designing it before that, but I could be wrong. You know, maybe somebody like Norman or somebody years ago.
How much did you get paid for designing the Daleks? Was it 50 quid?
Well,
it was a staff contribution, wasn't it?
Yes.
Of some nominal amount.
And then Ferry, so he designed it.
How much are they worth now?
What a Dalek. Well, it was just, I mean, they make them all the time. Or you could, there were kits that you could buy. You make your own TARDIS for God knows, your own Dalek for God knows what you, where you put it once you made it. It was based on the pepper pot, wasn't it, in the canteen?
Yeah. So why did it last?
You sat inside a little trunk.
That's right. You had to be short, didn't you, to be able to drive them,
yeah,
I think.
Only my actors and not claustrophobic.
And they could just about get up a small ramp, but they couldn't do steps.
Yeah.
So why didn't... I mean, they're quite old-fashioned now, aren't they, the Daleks, but they still survived in popularity.
Well, they were an icon, weren't they? A sort of icon of the whole series. Okay. You couldn't change
them. They had sink plungers.
That's right, sink plungers for things at the front.
Great, sort of.
Which I think they adapted the design and then used series a bit to make them look a little bit more realistic, but not much.
Incredibly ratty.
Mm.
So what were they made of originally? Just...
I think it was just bits. I mean, all the things on the outside.
Those knobs were those PVC presses, weren't they? Yeah.
They were just a sort of hierarchy. Were there black ones as well as silver ones? And the black ones were sort of like the
really
the, bad. Well, they were the real baddies as opposed to.
I don't know. It sort of rings bells, but I can't remember. I can only remember the silver and grey ones.
Well, that was Andre Wellsted Hornby and Graham Luff, who were set designers at the BBC. Please excuse my dodgy pronunciations earlier on. It's time for the poem now. Kirsten Powers is going to read a Sylvia Plath poem called Poppies in July.
Little poppies, little hell flames, do you no harm? You flicker, I cannot touch you. I put my hands among the flames, nothing burns, and it exhausts me to watch you flickering like that, wrinkly and clear red like the skin of a mouth just bloodied, little bloody skirts. There are fumes I cannot touch. Where are your opiates, your nauseous capsules? If I could bleed or sleep, if my mouth could marry a hurt like that, or your liquor seep to me in this glass capsule, dulling and stilling, but colorless, colorless.
Thank you, Kirsten Powers. Our next guest in the studio is Malcolm Grieve. Malcolm is an actor and he's here today to talk about pop music in the 70s and the impact it had on him as a teenager.
Don't want to stay alive when you're 25. And when you're stealing clothes from marks and sparks, Freddy's got spots from ripping up stock. Promise me this funky little
music, music, music. If music be the food of love, music of the spheres, the hills are alive. Everywhere the idea of music's part of our everyday language. But how important is it really? Well, for me at least, it helps us define who we are, our personality, our place in the world. And I do know people for whom music isn't that important. It's maybe something to put on in the background, to fill a space, fill a gap. What we're into, what turns us on, is very much an intrinsic part of our makeup. And something I find interesting is how that definition arises in each of us. And also how it's changed over the generations in the past, how it may change in the future, as music becomes more accessible, freer and easier to get hold of, more of a commodity. Growing up in the early 1970s, I was born in 1958, meant I was exposed to a huge variety of music, all with different fashions, and in some cases lifestyles and philosophies attached to it. And later on, as I got older, and I started to understand these things, different musics came by, and I understood that they were from whole different social backgrounds. But I remember my earliest experience as a callow 12, 13-year-old listening to Pick of the Pops with a spare loudspeaker in my bedroom, hastily assembled into a sheet of plywood and attached to a long wire which dangled from the back of my dad's huge 1940s valve radio. It was so now, so exciting, so private, and so mine. That, I suppose, was my first taste of music being not just in my world, but a defining part of it. That was helped maybe by the fact that my mum and dad didn't really like it very much. And while that of itself wasn't a new thing, it perhaps helped us to become a generation which routinely expected to disrespect our parents' world. But what I heard on Pick of the Pops wasn't just one sort of music. There was everything from old 60s-style ballads, cheesy pop, the odd novelty song, soul music, rock and roll, newer, harder rock songs, and of course, there were the beginnings of glam rock. It didn't take long for these things to start falling into categories, and in that whirl of hormones where you're desperate to identify yourself as an individual, yet somehow you always end up belonging to a tribe, it really didn't take long for me to start identifying myself with certain types of music. Some were obviously cool, even when I was that young. Some were very exciting and really quite dangerous. They were the sexy musics. Early Bowie and T-Rex, Roxy Music. You know, I think it's hard to overestimate the effect of such a relentlessly urban sound and the artist's glamorous and ambiguous images on a naive and hopeful youth. And though I knew that my sister had once climbed through a toilet window in Slough to get to see the Rolling Stones, who of course still sounded pretty good too, these were my sounds, and the impact of hearing such things at that age I don't ever think ever leaves you. But it wasn't just glam that I listened to. Perhaps the epitome of cool to me was the summer when I was in the third form. Three of our classrooms were in terrapin buildings, like porter cabins, and one was on the edge of the sports field. Can I pick up on that? But it wasn't just solely glam rock that I was into. Perhaps the epitome of cool to me was the summer when I was in the third form. Three of our classrooms were in terrapin buildings, like porter cabins, and one of these was on the edge of the sports field. This was 4T's room, and some of them we already knew. They were cool. Well, when they managed to bring a stereo in and fix the speakers into the windows of the Terrapin building facing out across the sports field, and they started playing Jethro Tull very loud at lunchtimes while we were playing football, that was a defining moment. It was for sure my very first festival feeling. Glorious summer days and music blaring out, and the start of perhaps the latent hippie rising in me. Yep, that's right. That was the start of my introduction to prog rock. And it felt very much by late night Radio 1 shows, including Top Gear, John Peel. That's when he started, I think, on Radio 1. And of course, by the beginnings of album swappings, you come into school clutching one or two prized possessions to exchange for a few days with your friends who had maybe something you hadn't heard before. But perhaps in part it was the grammar school surroundings and a subtle and also strong emphasis on the mind and the intellect, but these deeper and more clever, stranger types of music began to take over, even if they didn't completely eclipse the earlier icons. Perhaps also the atmosphere of the time, with a lot of revolutionary political ideas floating around, albeit badly formed and perhaps the more dangerous for it, fed into this too, that somehow it was no longer cool just to be into something we could somehow dismiss as pop music. Some groups, like early Genesis, for instance, appeared to us at least to be anti-establishment, which gave them a glamour quite beyond the urban glitz of the sexy musics. We were now part of the alternative society at 16, and prog became another tribe to belong to, and in some ways quite an exclusive one. Of course, there was an illusory element to this revolutionary belief we are part of, but it was a feeling that infused a lot of people at the time, and we felt it had a continuity from the 60s counterculture. It's perhaps interesting to ponder that people brought up in that time and infused with that somewhat evangelical feeling are in fact often now in positions of power and influence, and I'm not sure there's a counterculture of any real weight to pitch against them. But, in any rate, The breadth and depth of some of the music we listened to was immense. We discuss intricate details of the music, the structure, how many overdubs there were on Tubular Bells. Yes, I'm sure you remember that. What Yes's lyrics really meant. And we discussed these into the small hours at weekends. We'd search for spiritual truths among some of the jazz rock, and we learned about meditation and Eastern spirituality through listening to this music. You can't listen to albums like Love, Devotion, Surrender without beginning to look at the overt spirituality of the musicians. And of course, we all wanted to be able to play guitar like that. I still feel that the 1970s possibly had a greater variety of music in currency than any other decade, especially if you remember that punk was in fact a 1970s phenomenon, even if its influence extended way beyond that decade. It'll be interesting to see how future generations view music. It's much more accessible now, it's more commoditized. For instance, my 4-year-old son knows all the lyrics to The Secret Machines. And our friends with older children, they all listen to the same music their children do, so it's no longer a rebellion thing. Who knows? Who knows? But anyhow, there's something of a personal journey there, from those tentative explorations of my own world with the sounds of the time to define its boundaries, to the beginnings of sexual maturity, intellectual, spiritual and political growth. These things altogether form the cornerstones of the adult, and all of them had their own soundtrack. Well, I hope you found it interesting and entertaining. Maybe it helped trigger a memory or two as well. I think it's been as indulgent as one of those long prog rock solos. But then I never could say no to Yes. Thanks for listening.
Thank you very much, Malcolm Grieve. Well, that's the end of the show. That's it. The Dalek Radio. We'll be back next week, next Saturday, for another hour of news reports, interviews and live guests in the studio. Our guests this week were Martin Summers and Malcolm Grieve. The archive came from the audio collection here at the British Empire and Commonwealth Museum at Temple Meads. Features were by Dalek reporters Tony Gosling and Anthony Page, and the poem was read by Kristen Powers, and What's On was compiled by Jeff Sparks. If you're interested in joining our team, log on to our website at dialectsradio.co.uk. The producer of this week's show was Anthea Page. So it's goodbye from me, John Peters Coleman. Until the next week, au revoir.